Mini episode 955 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to mini episode number 955 of the FDH Lounge. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris here with two of our favorite guests that we've had over a period of time. We are bringing them together because the subject matter is so epic that we need both of them to really address it. It is year one of the Trump administration. Everything we've gone through, I think we've all collectively lived a decade in the last year. There has been so much that has gone on. And we're going to get some, as much as we can, I think, kind of big picture thoughts about what we can take away from the last year and what it augurs for the next couple of years going forward. Two of our favorite guests, as we say, of course, one of them is William Cohen, a tremendous author and great talking head that you can find on a lot of the great TV news and business shows, author of such books as we've covered over a period of time and spoken with him about in a number of these books on the show, Why Wall Street Matters, The Price of Silence, The Duke Lacrosse Scandal, Wall Street and the Power of the Elite, Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, The Last Tycoons, The Secret History of Lazard Frères and Company. Always a pleasure to have you on the show, sir. Great to have you back on, William. How are you today?
I'm great. Thank you for having me, Rick.
Pleasure to have you on. And another of our favorite guests over a period of time, from the great website epolitics.com, as well as being a contributor to campaigns and elections, somebody that I have developed a tremendous cross-partisan rapport with over a period of time. Somebody who has been on since, I believe, relatively early in the Obama administration, actually, discussing various political twists and turns. I remember at least as far back as the health care bill of 2010, if not further back, my good friend, the esteemed Colin Delaney of epolitics.com. Colin, always a pleasure to have you on, my man. How are you today?
It's always a pleasure to join you. Thanks so much. I really appreciate the intro, and I'm really looking forward to a good conversation.
I think we're going to have a very good one here. It's a pleasure getting to mix the perspectives of you two gentlemen from your various perches in covering national stories as they have been developing. And I'll start this one with you, William, and I think we'll go back and forth a little bit here. But I'll start with you as far as year one, and I'm curious how you look at it as somebody who has written as many books as you have and kind of focused on important titans from the perspective that you have. If you were looking at this from the perspective of doing a biography on Trump, what some of the things that you might take away from year one would be? I see a little bit of a dividing line here of when John Kelly became chief of staff. Maybe it's grading on the Trump curve, but it seems like things have been a little bit quieter and a little bit more like a standard administration in the time since, albeit the first 7 or 8 months were so crazy that that's really maybe not saying a whole heck of a lot. But as we've gone along, people love to talk about the shattering of norms, whether it be the family relationships in the White House, the business dealings, the ongoing situation with the Russia probe and the way that that's been handled. What are your takeaways from this journey that we've navigated over the first year, William?
Well, you know, I'll be honest. I'm still probably in somewhat, as a New Yorker, in disbelief that he really is our president. I still am probably in some state of shock that he was elected, that the American people, through the Electoral College, he was able to stitch together an Electoral College win despite losing the plurality of votes by 3 million. I think given what I knew about him and had written about him in the years leading up to him becoming a candidate, what New Yorkers know about him over the years and about his projects and his financial difficulties, and I think I'm still in disbelief that he was able to stitch together this Electoral College win and become the President of the United States. So I think that's what I bring to analyzing his first year. And I guess what I would say about the first year is that sort of everything I knew about him and feared about him has come true, and I think that hopefully other people in the country are getting to see what I think many people in New York already knew. And I think probably the one saving grace from my perspective is that his high degree of incompetence related to the job has actually worked to the benefit of the American people, because if he were any more competent, we would probably be reeling even more than we already are.
Well, that's a very interesting perspective, and one that I would be surprised if it wasn't mirrored somewhat by Colin. And turning to you, Colin, your thoughts on this. Again, I think that sense of bemusement that we're all here is widely shared, by myself included. I didn't see this coming as far as Trump's election, nor did I even initially see his nomination coming until it basically proved to be too late. So there's a lot of the same thing with me, I'm sure, with you, and I'm sure an awful lot of policy dread mixed in there as well, Colin.
Oh, definitely. And we can talk about the, I think we should definitely talk about the actual policy changes that are happening. You know, things are going to have consequences. Some of them, you know, may turn out to be a big deal in the long run and the short term. Other ones may last, you know, may not turn out to be as big a deal. Some may prove incredibly consequential 10 years down the road, right? But we can cover that another time. William, I loved what you said. I think my bemusement went away pretty quick. I mean, I got started in Texas politics, right? So you get used to all kinds of improbable people managing to do things, and certainly improbable people managing to get into power. You know, what I've really been struck by was the has been the fast rise of a people-powered movement to change politics that Trump has caused in reaction to him and his policies, right? To his personality as much as the policies. But there are a lot of people out there who are feeling the real and practical effects, and certainly fearing a lot more that could happen. And all across the country, really, I was just reading an article in the Post about a group of women in a small town in eastern Washington State, which, if you know anything about the Northwest, that's, you know, a pretty conservative, actually a very conservative area. But last January, they'd organized a local women's march, got several hundred people to come, or a couple of hundred people to come, which were out there is a lot. And since then, they've been organizing to turn out the vote in the November midterms, right? People are turning this kind of enthusiasm into, I think, you know, the potential for a whole new set of decision makers, people that may be able to come at things with a fresh perspective. Earlier this month, I did a couple of trainings and a couple of talks at a conference for Democratic candidates, most of whom were new candidates, a couple of hundred people from Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, Kentucky, around the D.C., you know, within driving distance of D.C. A lot of people in their 40s, 50s, 20s, 30s, you know, across the gamut, every demographic you could think of, running for office. And I was really struck by them. You know, you had your few who were kind of out there. You're always going to have that. But the majority of them seem like really grounded people that you might just trust to make good decisions. So there may well be a long-term change lurking right below the surface that Trump set in motion.
Well, I want to follow up on that with you, Kyle, and I'll start this round with you because of what you said there. There was an article that I had read just within the last hour, actually, on Politico that was actually kind of reinforcing an impression that I already had. And this is one of the stories that, unfortunately, the media has not really talked very much about. We pride ourselves on the show on spotlighting things beneath the surface a little bit, and that being that this animal that has been talked about in many different administrations actually seems to be happening here, the concept of cabinet government. You go back to the Nixon or the Carter governments, and the cabinet secretaries would be PO'd, that it was kind of a top-down kind of a thing. But the funny thing is that what William had referred to as far as, you know, the incompetence, the disinterest in policy, it's turning loose the cabinet members to go out there. And again, you and I, Colin, I know broadly speaking, from our past conversations, I have very little doubt how much we disagree on the rightness of this and of taking a different approach on some of these things here. What I might call reforms, what you would call sort of smashing the system. But it's an interesting thing that is really not getting much byplay out there is that this cabinet is one of the most powerful cabinets probably that we've ever had.
That's an interesting way to put it. Does black get blacker? How much darker does evil get? That's an interesting point. You know, the power of the cabinet has risen in relative terms because there's so little central direction from the White House. I definitely see what you're getting at there. However, you know, you can point to a couple of activist cabinet members, and fortunately, thank God for all of us, they're going to lead to more air pollution, more asthma, more cancer in the population. God bless them, you know. But Zinke and Pruitt, right, are about the two that come to mind. You know, under the surgeon, the neurosurgeon, housing is just, it's basically not functioning, right? A lot of programs, the decisions that need to be made simply can't be made, so grants are not going to go out. This is being repeated across the federal government. Ben Carson, thank you very much, yes. The neurosurgeon. But yeah, it's being repeated across the bureaucracy, right? Because they haven't filled so many of these positions,
right?
Some of these agencies are just paralyzed. That's not devolving power to the agencies. That's choosing to screw up the functioning of government intentionally.
Well, I'll tell you what, and where I agree with you, you and I don't often find common cause on policy, but I'll agree with you. I think it's horrific incompetence not to staff at least the top levels of the agencies, because that's your eyes and ears on the bureaucracy. For an administration that claims to be so concerned about the deep state, one would think they would want people in there at the top keeping an eye out on things. One of many contradictions in the age of Trump. And turning to you on this, William, I'd love to get your thoughts on this, because again, you know, in your reporting and your books that you've done previously, you've done a lot to kind of go under the surface of some of the things of what the media covers, not least of which on the Duke LaCrosse case. But this is one of these stories that, to me, is being critically underreported, that whatever you think of the effects of it, pro or con, in terms of empowering these cabinet secretaries, people look at it on the surface if they think of this cabinet and they think, they're a bunch of suck-ups, they're a bunch of puppets, they go to the cabinet meetings where they're all professing their personal loyalty to Trump, and that's the only impression people seem to have of this cabinet. But it's a cabinet that, because of Trump's disinterest, his deep disinterest in policy, has a wide degree of latitude in public policy that almost seems unparalleled in recent times.
I don't know, Rick. I've heard this discussion with Colin was saying what you were saying. I'm not sure I totally agree with you, because I think to some extent, you know, a cabinet member, a cabinet secretary, can only be as empowered as the President of the United States allows him or her to be. And I think this president, because of his extreme incompetence and indifference to policy and governing, and he seems to only care about his tweeting and his headlines and how many times people talk about him on television, I think he is, you know, continuously undercut a number of key cabinet ministers. I mean, you know, he is completely undercut Jeff Sessions, right, who's his attorney general.
Yes.
I mean, have we heard that he wants to fire him? How many times have we heard that Rex Tillerson is either about to get fired or about to leave? So those are the two, like, traditionally most powerful cabinet secretaries, and both of them have completely, it seems to me, lost favor with Trump. You know, then this past week, we saw, I think, in Axios stories about how Trump now doesn't like Wilbur Ross. Wilbur Ross is falling asleep in meetings. He hasn't been tough enough on trade. You know, Rick Perry, I mean, Colin, you probably know Rick Perry better than most. I mean, Rick Perry, to me, is a total buffoon. He always has been. And then if you read, you know, Michael Lewis's excellent article, my colleague from Vanity Fair, his article about the Energy Department under Rick Perry, you see that it's completely dysfunctional.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that perhaps, you know, Ryan Zinke, his Interior Secretary, has probably been more damaging because, therefore, I guess, quote unquote, more powerful because he's, you know, been able to allow for drilling in the Anwar. He's, I guess, allowed for drilling to take place on all the coasts of the country. He's, you know, rescinded some of the protection of land. You know, the Bear Monument. I mean, so he's probably done a lot of damage in his way. But you know, it's like Steve Mnuchin. I mean, somehow he was able to steer this tax bill into law. He probably gets credit for that. But on the other hand, he's also shot himself in the foot with several damaging media spectacles, whether it was at Fort Knox during the eclipse or he and his wife looking over a page of $20 bills that he had just signed at the currency, at the mint. And so, you know, I don't know. I think that this cabinet is actually basically a bunch of people who are buffoons, who are disinterested, like Trump is, and frankly only did it so they could get the certificate that allows them to defer the tax on their huge fortunes. And so, I don't know. I'm not seeing a powerful cabinet. I'm not seeing a powerful executive branch at all, frankly.
That's a very eloquent and effective pushback on my thesis there, William. And certainly the Tillerson example and the Sessions ones, yeah, those are the low-hanging fruit there for you because, yes, one cannot describe those two as being empowered on a policy level or anything else. So touche, certainly at least on that part. I want to stick with you and start the next round here, William, as far as that goes. In terms of a little bit of what you were talking about there, a little bit with, again, the disinterest in policy that Trump has and the disengagement which leads to, if you were to try to pin down exactly at this moment where the Republican Party stands on a lot of issues, there's maybe not a whole lot of focus because it almost sort of depends on where Trump is going any kind of the day of the week. And Congress, that's what you see on a lot of these votes that have failed in the last year and legislation that they've struggled to push, is because nobody seems to necessarily know where to go to follow the president. On the other side, the Democratic Party, as often happens in times of opposition, has been incredibly unified, as were the Republicans under Obama, and fairly effective, as the Republicans were in the first term, at least under Obama, in sticking together. So when we look at this, with the midterms coming up, as Colin noted, obviously the energy and the passion favors the Democrats, which we haven't said that in a midterm in a long time, but it is the case. But I'm curious what you think in terms of looking at this, because the center of gravity on the Democratic side unquestionably has shifted to the left. I think it started first with the social issues in terms of gay marriage and where that went, and I think the economics have followed to where if you're running for president, you've pretty much got to be in favor of a $15 minimum wage, you know, the public option for health care, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm sorry, single payer. But in terms of where this is going to go, there's the one school of thought that says the Democrats have gone too far to the left, that they're going to be a liability against the Republicans. The other theory would be in the age of Trump being the wrecking ball that kind of proved we have no more rules, maybe the Democrats don't pay a price for this. So what are you thinking, William?
Again, it's tough to be a prognosticator in the age of Trump. I never would have thought that he would win in the first place. Again, I cannot possibly imagine anything but a massive reversal of power, a power shift in November of 2018. I don't know whether that means that the Democrats will win the Senate and the House, just the Senate, just the House, but I mean, my guess is that the revulsion level of Trump about Trump and what he stands for and how you know, how sour people are as a result of his presidency, I cannot imagine there's a major political reversal come November. But there are mitigating factors. The mitigating factors are, obviously, I was wrong about Trump in the first place. There are 60 million people who seem to think he's great. And, when you listen to the radio or on TV and they have, like, the Trump person speaking, the Trump person thinks that he's doing a great job. I mean, just can't believe what a great job he's doing. And I say to myself, oh, my God, I can't believe what a horrific job he's doing. And thank goodness he's doing such a horrific job, or else it would be even worse. And if the economy, don't forget, is the economy stupid? You know, George Stephanopoulos' great line that got Clinton elected. If in fact, the Dow continues to power forward, which I'm gobsmacked about nearly every day, I don't think we've gotten much GDP growth despite all the blithering that comes out of the White House. I don't think that's really picked up. But, I mean, people might say to themselves, because of this tax law, that, I got a $1,000 bonus thanks to Trump, or my minimum wage is now up to $15 an hour or something. People might actually say that they're feeling a little bit better about the economy, or they're feeling a little bit better about their paychecks. And that could redound to his benefit, as much as I find that, absolutely, a game of a house of mirrors. I mean, I just think that it would be extremely unfortunate if he retained some power after November 2018. I think the best outcome for the country will be that he be neutered after November 2018.
Some great points there. I almost wish, not that what I wish matters in a case like this, but I almost wish that the Democrats could win the House and not the Senate, because I'm afraid that the pressure for impeachment would be great, and they would not win, right? Republicans, you're not going to get two-thirds vote in the Senate. So I almost wish that we get the House, and then, 50-50 in the Senate sounds great. Because if we get 51, we'd all, there's functionally still nothing we can do. On your original question, Rick, about the party pushing to the left, it is true that on a number of things, the party is a good bit more left than it was.
Yes.
In some ways, it's more left than Obama. But at the same time, there's a generational shift happening, right? More young people are identifying as Democrats. The Bernie crowd was a mix of young people and sort of earnest, centrist, good government liberals, the kind of people who backed Bill Bradley back in the day. But I think the press really and the punditry really overplays the ideological divide in the party. There are certainly groups that are pulling the party in different directions. My friends over at the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, I have a lot of friends in the Bernie movement. I think that they make more noise than they have influence on who's actually going to get elected. The House is going to be, it's 435 individual races. And like I said earlier, I had the chance to talk to a few of these candidates and a lot of staff, and they're going to run local races based on who they are and their issues. So it's useful to talk about the overall policy shifts, but I really do think that a long-term change that we cannot overlook and downplay is people are running for city council now who are going to be senators in 10 years. The Republicans have remained unified. Basically, they've circled the wagons. If you recall, there was a memo that got circulated back in, 2012 or 2016, that was basically, this was the last election when the dwindling white conservative minority could hold on to power. So, it was very important that Trump win. There's a circle of the wagons mentality over there. They're defying so many of their own norms that I cannot imagine that they have to pay a penalty. I mean, think about Franklin Graham, right, who, his father, Billy Graham, pastor to the president, and here he's giving Trump a pass. Jerry Falwell Jr., faced a near revolt at Liberty because of his, supporting Trump. He gave Trump a pass on all the moral stuff on the tape, the you know, the Grabham tapes. So, you know, if you are a young conservative, a young Christian conservative right now, the Republican Party is not offering you a positive vision. They're associating you and your leaders with men who might molest your sister.
Wow, that's a strong take. But well, listen, I'll tell you this: as a Midwestern social conservative, look, I roll my eyes at the same things you're talking about right there. I love Justice Gorsuch. I think he's a tremendous justice from my point of view. But I roll my eyes at all the ring kissing about you know, how God Trump has delivered us all this stuff. I hear you on that, Colin. I think that's ridiculous as well from the religious leaders. I also have a more cynical take on what you said about the generational shift. That being from my, you know, old man screaming get off the lawn perspective, I would say millennials think money grows on trees, and I would think that might explain some of that. But on economics,
have you talked to any millennial veterans lately? Because there are a lot of them.
Okay,
there are a lot of them walking around D.C. right now. I see fit young men every now and then on artificial legs. So there's some millennials out there who don't think money grows on trees, man.
Man, I will exempt veterans from any negative critique I ever make of anything. That's my, you got me there. I will never say a bad word about the, yeah. Way to punch me in the soft spot there, Colin. But I'll start the last round here with you, which is actually on the subject of economics and of where we're going. William touched on it before briefly, which is the way the economy's going. People are going to be looking at their paychecks this year. My sense is kind of multifaceted on this. I think Trump is a moron for bragging about the stock market. There's a reason presidents don't do that, because when it goes south, what do you say then? So I think it's idiotic. But I think to some degree, again, you and I will disagree about whether it's a deleterious thing or not, but Trump has certainly set a deregulatory tone in the first year. I think that's unquestionable from any perspective. I think that has had something to do with some kind of unleashing. I think the tax plan will probably go further. We may very well be having a bubble. I agree with William, and I think the stock market's a bubble right now, but I think 2018 is going to be a pretty hot year. I don't think it's going to be set, I mean, all things being equal, right? If Trump can refrain from nuking North Korea or anything like that, I think it's going to be a hot year, maybe the hottest since 2000, which isn't saying much because we've had a pretty low growth 21st century so far. But if we have that kind of a year, what does that do to the projections about this kick in the crotch that Trump and the Republicans are supposed to get in the midterms?
Well, let me get in my cheap joke for the night. We know it's going to be a hot year because three of the last 5 years have been the hottest on record up to that point. How about that?
You're nothing if not predictable, my man. Good one.
Oh, good. I'm credit for that. Dan on message, man.
Yeah.
No, seriously, the economy is ticking along. You know, it's possible that there is some effect. I think it would be functionally impossible at this point to quantify any effect from any regulatory change. You know, you think about, like, the offshore drilling, for instance, it will be years before anything's permitted. It'll be years before anything's drilled. All those rule changes are going to get held up. Often, you know, their incompetence is going to show, the cabinet members' incompetence is going to show when their orders get shut down because they violated some, you know, obscure piece of federal rulemaking, right? But as far as the economy broadly goes, you know, the world is hot right now, right? Europe is up. You know, European economy is doing a half point better than had been. You know, Asia's bouncing along. China's slowing down over time, but they're still growing at, you know, high single digits. So regardless of what happens at home, the world economy is still moving. If anything, you know, in a year or two, the danger might be overheating. It's great that we lowered taxes, increased deficit, which will push up interest rates. That's a really smart decision to do right now, yeah. But but the question about the effects on the actual election.
Yes.
You know, I don't know what practical effects it has to go from, say, 2.25 to 2.75 GDP growth. You know, right now, unemployment is already, you know, as it's measured, is already low. You know, we know that there's a lot of underemployment and that kind of thing still. But there are plenty of fields that are hopping, and there are plenty of people who, you know, are able to put together a reasonable living, at least survivable living off of things like Uber and stuff like that than, you know, used to be able to. So, you know, I think if corporations should at some point have to raise wages because, you know, if you're at 4%, they're going to be competing for the good workers in theory. So far, it doesn't seem to have played out in practice. But, you know, things are going okay. When you survey people about their own economic prospects, they generally, you know, you generally see like two-thirds positive, you know, in that general neighborhood. I think people in general feel good about their own prospects. Many of them feel like the country is going in the wrong place, both on the left and right, because of their political views, right? But when you ask them about their own personal finances, they'll say they're doing all right. So, short version, an uptick in economics probably won't make any difference because a good economy is already baked in. The fact that Trump is this unpopular, with the economy ticking along as well as it's, you know, as well as it's going, is remarkable. So, what with his, the one thing I do fear is if there is any kind of economic problem with the dividing lines in the country as sharp as they are, that it might not take much to push some people over the edge. Fear does bad things to people, as we have seen in our own past. So this is not a good time for economic dislocation any more than the late 1920s was.
Well, that's a very good point. Not that there's ever a good time for it, but sometimes they're worse than others. And to bring it around to you here, William, again, very few people, I think, know more about finance and the economy than you. So I'd be interested to get your thoughts on this and where we're going into this election, because, again, particularly post-tax cut, Trump owns this economy. To the extent that it's an economic referendum in 2018, A, that's, I would guess that's a good thing for him, but B, yeah, all things being equal, because it looks like it's going to be a good year, but that part's going to be interesting to see what it can offset on the other side of it. I had heard in the last election, and this was people saying, and we all thought, of course, Hillary was going to win, so everybody was thinking 2020 at the earliest. I heard a couple people say, gee, whoever comes after Hillary, there's going to be, if there's a deregulatory climate, that's really going to help unleash a lot of things here because of the way that things have gone in the 8 years under Obama and the strict regulatory climate that there was. Nobody seemed to think Trump was going to win. Trump wins, and some of the things I was hearing about during the election have actually come to pass. Again, how much that's had to do with the economy, some, I guess, will dispute that. But your thoughts, William, on how the economy basically could kind of change what looks to be kind of a baked-in cake for this year. It looks like it's going to be a big Democratic year, but in times of peace and prosperity, and keeping our fingers crossed on peace, of course, incumbent parties tend to do fairly well. So what are your thoughts going into the fall with that being the case?
Well, I think that, you know, the last president to sort of, quote, to unleash, quote-unquote, the animal spirit in the economy was, you know, George W. Bush. He had a head of the SEC, Christopher Cox, who had been a California congressman who didn't know the first thing about finance or the economy, and he basically, you know, had what we call sort of a light-touch regulatory environment. Regulators rarely showed up on Wall Street, rarely examined what Wall Street was up to. And of course, that resulted in you know, the biggest financial crisis of our lifetimes and one of the largest in our country's history. So what are we doing? We're basically going back to that kind of free flowing deregulated environment and extracting nothing in return for doing that. Basically, Trump is saying to his appointees at the Fed and at the SEC and at CFTC and other regulatory bodies, you know, he's trying to repeal parts of Dodd-Frank. You know, whatever you guys want is fine. We're just going to take all the shackles off. We're going to deregulate everything, as if you know, having no seat belts and having no speed limits and just saying, you want to drive on the wrong side of the road with a whiskey bottle in your hand? Go ahead. I mean, that's basically what he's saying now, and we've seen how this particular play ends. We saw it in 2007 and 2008 with the financial crisis. I really don't see any reason. I mean, just like then, nobody could really see where it was coming from. I mean, you know, we had sort of cracks. We could see that, you know, perhaps the housing market was getting overheated. Yeah, I mean, so people realized that perhaps these mortgage-backed securities that were being packaged up with defaulting mortgages should never have happened. That's easy to see in retrospect. Very few people saw that along the way. And just like now, we've got the Dow at 26,000. We've got interest rates at historic lows, which create all sorts of what I call yield hunger games with people reaching for yield all over the place. This is not a healthy economy. Oh, my God, it feels like we're partying. This is, you know, till it's 1999. But it just is not sustainable. It can change on a dime. It can change for any number of reasons very quickly, and then we'll be looking back and saying, my God, what were we thinking? And if that happens before November, then it's going to be a bloodbath. It might happen in terms of the Republican Party. If it happens, I still think there'll be consequences just because of how unpopular Trump is, just like we saw the election of a Democrat in Alabama. You know, we've seen in various local races the unexpected has happened because just people, I think, are disgusted by this president of the United States and how disrespectful he has been of American values.
Well said.
That's a very interesting point as far as if there's a bad economy at the time of this election, just how brutal that could be for Trump. But that kind of thing, it generally needs to start happening by about spring or summer, I think, for that thought really to kind of take root by fall, because these perceptions can kind of take a while to change. But boy, if it did change in time, that's a very good point there, William. And again, one of a number of characteristically good points. We always enjoy having you on the show, of course. You can check him out at William Cohen on Twitter or WilliamCohen.com. And all of the books that we mentioned previously, you can click through to available for purchase there, as well as at ePolitics and ePolitics.com for Colin Delaney. William, thank you so much for being on with us again. Really appreciate your time, sir.
Thank you. Colin,
thanks so much, my friend. Great to have you back on. You brought a lot, as always. Appreciate it.
Oh, wonderful. Really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks so much.
What a great panel with you two. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you for being on. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to FDH Lounge mini-episode number 955.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Aquafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.